I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Today I am here in Atlanta, Georgia with author Tito Perdue, and we're going to have a conversation about his life, his work, his art, and his philosophy, and especially his political views. So Tito, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit just about your life in general, a brief outline when you were born, what you've done for a living, your education, things like that.
Well, I had the great good fortune of being born in Chile, South America, where my father was an electrical engineer employed by the Braden Company. So I spent my first 3 years out of this country, and my parents required me to return to this country at the outbreak of World War II because they did not want to be out of the country when the war was raging. So I came back to Alabama, which was my father's and mother's home states, and settled in a little town in northeast Alabama called Anniston, Alabama, where I grew up. And I had a typical American Huckleberry Finn type childhood until I reached the age of 14, whereupon my parents began to realize that I was not being properly educated by the public schools. And sent me to a private school, a brand new private school being set up south of Birmingham called Indian Springs School. It was an all a boys school, boarding school. And I attended all 4 years at that school. And I think that's really where I got turned on, where I became conscious of what study meant, what literature could be, of what knowledge itself could be, and I learned that knowledge is more fun than football or baseball, and began to attach myself to it. I was always attracted to fine writing, but never imagined that I could do that I myself could ever create a novel, much less a series of novels, because I thought it was simply beyond any ability that I might have. But I did become attached to other writers, most particularly Thomas Wolfe, who was a perfect writer for an adolescent boy. And the fact that he had grown up in North Carolina, not too far from where I was, attracted me even more to him. And I still do like Thomas Wolfe because of the quality of his prose, because of his emotionality, and because of the brilliance of his writing. So if I had to pick one source that excited me about literature, it would have to be Thomas Wolfe. I liked him so much that during one Christmas vacation, I went to North Carolina, and I talked to relatives of his who were still living at that time. We're talking about 1955. He had sisters and uncles that were still alive. I was able to interview him and able to write a paper about him, which was required for my graduation from high school. So I became absolutely entranced by Thomas Wolfe. Then, next, Faulkner, William Faulkner, who was a deeper writer, no doubt, also very Southern, and it just so happened that his nephew was my roommate at Indian Springs School. So I invested some time in Faulkner and came to like him, I suppose, even better than Wolfe. And then from there, my interest in my ability to perceive to appreciate literature expanded, and I began to get into the Russian novelists, particularly Dostoevsky, and began to get into American realist writers like Nelson Algren, for example. And all this time, I looked upon writing as something that was beyond me. So I thought that the best that I could do would be to become maybe a publisher. Or an English professor, or even a bookseller, something to do with literature, but never thought that I could myself be a writer. So I finished Indian Springs, and I went off to Antioch College in Ohio. That was the most left-wing college in the country, and I was very left-wing when I was 17 years old. I wanted to go to the most left-wing of all possible places, and did go, and loved it at first, a tremendous freedom. First time in my life, I didn't have to go to bed at 10 o'clock at night. You know, for the first time in my life, I could go to a tavern and have a beer. I mean, I had been constrained in my private school where I was tightly supervised. Suddenly, I was free. And I could chase girls, and I could drink beer, and could stay up all night, and I could talk to people who knew something about writing, people who knew something about philosophy and history. It was a paradise for me. But then I made the social mistake of spending the night in a hotel with my sweetheart. That off campus, I was off campus, it was on holiday, and yet this most liberal of all colleges could not permit that. So I, my girlfriend, my best friend, and his girlfriend were all expelled, immediately expelled from college. And I began to see some of the weaknesses of people who claim to be transgressive, who claim to be tolerant, but really are not. Because they expel me for doing something that today would be considered pro forma.
Right.
So I was kicked out of school, and I had to find a school to go to. And I had to find a school that was inexpensive, because I had no money. My parents had pretty well disinherited me by this time. So there I was, age 18, with a wife, and no college to speak of behind me. So I'm very grateful to the University of Texas for having even allowed me to enter. They did allow me to enter, and the tuition there at that time was $25 a semester, which I could afford, which was about the only kind of tuition I could afford. I went to Texas. I went to Austin. By the way, Austin at that time was a tiny little town, unlike any, not remotely like what it is today. It was a town occupied mostly by Mexicans and by college students. And the college students that occupied it were mostly fraternity boys who were fascinated by football and not much else. The academic standards were not high, although there were some good teachers there. So I went to the University of Texas, and I did well. I liked it, and stayed for a couple of years. My wife, meanwhile, was supporting me by working as a clerk in a department store. Her salary was less than $100 a month, and yet we were able to live on that. So we lived in poverty for a couple of years. Then my child was born, and that made things more difficult. We could not live on $100 a month while paying tuition, going to school, raising a child. So I decided to go to the big city where money could be had, which happens to be, of course, New York City. So I got in my 20-year-old DeSoto automobile that my father had gotten me. I had my 100-pound boxer dog that I had adopted. I had a 6-week-old baby. And I threw it all into this ancient car and headed off for New York City, to the big city. I had no idea what I was getting into. I mean, you talk about a babe in big woods. I was just utterly lost when I got to New York. And we managed to spend a few nights with my wife's parents. He himself was ill at the time. They were not in good financial shape either. So all of us crowded into their little home out on Long Island. And I, the next morning, I got up to seek my career in the big city. I had no degree. I had a total of $17 in my pocket. I had a child who was sick. Uh-huh. I had a wife who had not yet fully recovered from childbirth. And I took the Long Island Railroad into Manhattan, Penn Station, got off at Penn Station. I didn't even know where I was. Uh-huh. And took subway down to the financial district, went to an employment agency. And when he found out I didn't have a college degree, he seemed to have very little interest in me. But he did have an opening for a bookkeeper, or rather an assistant bookkeeper with the mutual fund company down on Wall Street, down on Broadway Street. And he sent me down for an interview, and I was scared to death. I mean, I had never interviewed for a job before. And the The human resources person looked at me askance. I'm sure I was dressed in a funny way because I'm a Southerner. And he sat me down in front of a calculator. And he said, Mr. Perdue, if we had 1.2 million shares of IT&T and the price is 32.78, what's the total value of that? And I had about 3 seconds to answer. And all I knew was that if you multiply a number by 10, you just add a zero to the number, and that means it's been multiplied by 10.
Right.
And this was 30-something, so it would be you add a zero, and you multiply approximately by 3, and that will give you the rough the rough answer.
Right.
So I was able to come up with the right answer. And he did that 2 or 3 times. He figured I was, you know, mathematically gifted. So he gave me the job. And my job was essentially a clerical job to help the bookkeepers keep their records straight. My job was to calculate the value of the portfolio at the end of each market day. That was not particularly difficult. I could do that. And I stayed with Dreyfus Corporation for about a year and began to hanker for wanted to go back and finish my degree. Meanwhile, my wife had been working and had we'd saved $700, total of $700. We knew that we were wealthy. You know, anybody who's got $700 is wealthy. So we hopped on a train, went back to Austin, Texas. I jumped back into school, and I think I was given a small scholarship. I had very good grades. I was studying Greek and psychology. I had a good record there. So they let me back in. And I did finish my degree in English literature. I had a double major in English and history. And once I had my bachelor's degree, then I realized that I was made for life. You know? I mean, anybody with a bachelor's degree has succeeded in life. So having not learned from my first experience, back to New York I went. This time, it's a strange thing that every time I interviewed for a job, I always got it. I never failed an interview for some reason. I think it was my southern accent that charmed them. But anyway, they hired me, and I went to work for the Royal Globe Insurance Company, which was down in William Street, still in the financial district of New York City. And they gave me a job what do they call it, job?
Underwriter.
Yes, underwriter. I was insurance underwriter. Though really, I was just an assistant underwriter at first. And my job was to review insurance applications and decide who did and did not deserve to be given insurance. And it was a strange job. But we would send detectives out to examine applicants to see whether they were living sane lives or not, and whether they deserved insurance. And if a person turned out to be of dubious legality, he would be denied insurance. And so that's what I did. I examined applications, and I allowed some people to be given casualty insurance, others not. It was boring as hell. I mean, unimaginably boring. The only exciting thing that ever happened to me was when Rockefeller applied for automobile insurance. And he had like 30 cars, 30 automobiles, and he wanted to insure all of them under one policy. So we sent an investigator out to look at his cars and to interview his neighbors, make sure that he was a safe driver, as if he did his own driving.
Right.
And we ended up giving him the insurance. The premium was out of this world. We had to pay an enormous premium to insure 30 cars. But we did give him insurance. And that went on for quite a while, for about a year. And I became thoroughly sick. I mean, I'm not a businessman. I don't like business. It bores me to death. So I decided I wanted to go to graduate school and get a degree in Latin American history. I had become interested in Latin America, partly because I had lived in Texas and had been to Mexico.
And partly because you were born there.
That's right. That's another reason. So I went back to Texas, and my first day of class, the graduate teacher wanted to know what languages I was familiar with. And he assumed that you were familiar with Spanish. That wasn't good enough. He'd also want you to be familiar with Portuguese. He also wanted you to know maybe a little French if you're interested in Haiti. And I didn't know any of those languages at the time. And he made it clear to me that I was not qualified for graduate school. And he was undoubtedly correct about that. So if I couldn't go to school in the area in which I wanted, maybe she should at last go to school, because she'd been working me through undergraduate for years. And she'd always wanted to go to college herself, but had put it off to get me through. So I had to find a job. Instead of her working me through, it was time for me to work her through. So I applied at the highway department, the University of the State of Texas Highway Department, because I knew a fellow who worked there. He worked in a laboratory. This laboratory had the duty of inspecting equipment that the highway department used in order to make highways. Paint, highway paint, asphalt, all the materials that go into a highway. All of these things have to meet specifications. So my job was to make sure that they did meet specifications. And my job was to go out to paint companies and actually watch them manufacture the paint, make sure it had all the ingredients, make sure the end product was of quality, make sure the little reflectors that you see along the highway, make sure they reflected enough light. The job became odder and odder. Finally, I was put in a room that was about 50 feet long, painted black inside. I would mount a reflector at one end of that room, walk back to the other end of the room, shine a light on it, and then make a notation as to how much light was reflected back to see if the reflectors were adequate. I would do this 8 hours a day, walking back and forth in this black room. But it wasn't an unpleasant job. And the people I worked with were Southerners. I felt more at home.
Mm-hmm.
Texans. I get along well with Texans. And meanwhile, Judy was going to school and studying languages, studying Russian, French, and German, making a good grade. And once again, I felt like I needed to go back to school. I couldn't stay out of school going 2 or 3 years without yearning to go back again. So we applied to Indiana University, and where they had a very good language program, excellent language program, and it's the most beautiful language program in the country. You can get a PhD in Tibetan or Hungarian or almost anything you can think of. And they had a good history department. So we traveled. I packed up my child, packed up 2 footlockers full of belongings, which were all that we had. Most of those were books. I ran off to Bloomington, Indiana. Fell in love with the place right away. Bloomington, wonderful little town, at least in those days, 1965. And I went to school. And Judy finished up her degree in French. And I began working on a master's degree in European history. I worked under Dr. Harry Young, who had been an agent for the CIA, who was an expert in German history. Very good professor. And I studied under him for a year and a half, for 2 years, and then got a master's degree in modern European history. And then But I knew I could not get a decent job just with a master's degree in European history. So I studied library science so I could at least get a job. And I wanted to remain on campus. And with a library degree, you can work in the library and stay on campus. Meanwhile, she, Judy, had finished her degree in French and German and had gotten a job in the beautiful university library in Indiana. And she had gotten a job there and had begun work on a library degree herself. Then I got an offer from the University of Iowa to work in their special collections department. So we moved to Iowa City, and I worked in the library in the special collections department, and Judy got a job at the law library at the University of Iowa, and finished up her library degree. So we were both librarians at this moment. And meanwhile, a much better job had opened up at Iowa State University, right across the state from Iowa City. I took that job as a bibliographer, which was a good job, and allowed me a couple of $1 million to spend on books so I could build the university collection. And that was fun. I could buy books from Europe and from all around. I could buy used books. I could negotiate prices. I could buy newly published books. I mean, that was fun. I could. It's a lot of fun to select books that you think ought to be in the library and to buy them with state money.
So it sounds like paradise to me.
Yeah, it was a good job. It was a good job. And Judy got her library degree. She already had her library degree. What were you doing at Iowa State? Oh, that's right. Judy was working in the same library. Despite nepotism rules, they hired both of us. And Judy also was working as a cataloger in the library, later as a gifts librarian in the library. And we had a farm. We bought a little 20-acre farm on the outskirts of Ames, Iowa. And we began, for the fun of it, began raising bees and producing honey. And Judy became fascinated by the little creatures and started studying entomology. It just so happened Iowa State had a terrific entomology department. So she began studying entomology. And while I was in the library buying books, she was out in the academic department studying entomology and got her master's degree there in entomology. And then we, what?
Now we got married.
Yeah, my daughter got married. And, and what's that?
And I cried.
And Judy graduated with her master's degree.
We left.
And we left, and we went to Binghamton. So then I got a job as the assistant director of the library at the New York, University of New York at Binghamton. That was supposed to be a really choice job. I was the second or third person in the library, and I had a staff of people working under me who all were charged with building the library collection. And that was a pretty good job. But my supervisor happened to be mentally ill, which made it a little harder. And nobody could stand to work with her for more than a short time. And I put up with her, and she put up with me for about a year. And it became impossible. I mean, she genuinely was a mental case. And she was the affirmative action appointee. She was a black woman who was by no means qualified to be an administrator. And hardly anybody came to work at that library and stayed more than 2 or 3 months before they had to leave, because she could not be dealt with. She was impossible to work with. I managed for a year to work for her. Under her, and you were in the law library. Bill, what were you doing?
I was taking classes.
Oh,
and then we applied to get down south. We were trying to get down.
Yeah, well, I wanted to get back down south.
Right.
So I was offered a job. I applied at Emory University. They had an associate directorship open. And I applied, and I got the job. It's a strange thing that I've ever always gotten the first job I ever applied for, some sort of magic. I don't know what time to account for. Maybe it's my beautiful face. I don't know. Anyway, I got this luscious job at Emory as associate director of the library. And when I got there, we had to live in Rome, in Athens. We lived in Athens, so Judy could continue her graduate work. So I had to commute from Athens, Georgia, to Atlanta, Georgia, every day, you know, and it took an hour and a half, 3 hours a day I was on the highway. The job turned out to be not nearly as delicious as I had thought it would be, primarily because of the personalities of some of the people, and because I didn't really have a full staff. I wasn't given the 20-member staff that I had been promised, because many of them had split jobs for doing other things besides just working for me. So I was always competing with their other supervisor for their time, having a hard time to get enough time from these people to do what they were expected to do. And once again, my boss and I were did not get along well. So at that point, we had saved a bit of money by this time. It seemed to us at the time that we had a fortune. We had $100,000. I said, my goodness, you know, I can retire on $100,000. So I did.
Uh-huh.
I just quit and said I'd be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, Judy had gotten a fellowship that paid a little bit, paid about $500 a month. And we had the interest off of my $100,000. And between the two of them, we could survive at a low level, but we could survive. Then I set to work writing at last. You know, I was 44 years old. Last able to start writing. I was retired. I was 44 years old. And I was going to write. So I sat down at my desk to write my first day of writing. And my mind was utterly blank. You know, what do I write about? So I sat at that desk for about 6 weeks. And then suddenly started writing. And the first book I wrote was dreadful. I mean, you know, I threw it away. It's hopeless. But the last part of that book seemed to me not so bad. And I decided to do what all writers, I suppose, do, and that is to start off autobiographically. So I wrote an autobiography. All I knew about novels was that novels are very long. So my obligation was to write a long story. So I ended up writing about 1,000 pages before I realized it was too long. So then I went back and rewrote it. By the way, this was before computers.
Oh, wow.
And I was writing on a manual typewriter. And the way I could copy my manuscripts were on a Xerox machine. This was before printers, before computers. This was manual work. So I rewrote the book and let Judy read it. She thought it was good. And I began submitting it. I had no idea about how to submit a book to a publisher. You know, I didn't go to an agent. I didn't have a friend to help me. I just started sending these manuscripts in to editors and chiefs of all the big publishers. But of course they bounced them right back again. I don't think they even looked at them. You know, these publishers have thousands of manuscripts coming in. One publisher told me that when he got to work in the morning, there'd be 200 or 300 of them sitting by his door, you know, to weep, and they just mostly chucked them into another room, where they throw unnecessary manuscripts? Slush pile. They threw them in the slush pile, and then I'm sure they never looked at them. So after 3 or 4 months would go by, I would ask, "Hey, have you looked at my book yet?" They'd say, "No, we haven't seen it yet." So I'd wait another 2 or 3 months. "No, we haven't looked at that yet, you know." I began to realize, you know, it was hopeless. Finally, I hit pay dirt when I submitted this first manuscript that I had written. I submitted it to a brand new little publisher called Four Walls, Eight Windows. Four Walls, Eight Windows, which was an enterprise started by Dan Simon and another guy, I can't remember his name, and who had started a small press. And it soon developed a big name as a good small press. They published my first book.
And that is?
Well, the first book that was published was Leap.
Right.
Not the first one I wrote.
Yeah.
The first book I wrote was not published still for another couple of years. So Lee was the first book I published. It's a very transgressive book. And the hero is a really alienated human being. And it's a devastating book. You know, it's very harsh upon people. And a lot of people don't like it. Some people do like it. It's a short book. I think in print it's less than 200 pages. But at least I was published. I had to wait between the time they accepted it and the time they printed it. It was like 2 years. I had to wait a long time for the book actually. I was never sure it would appear. Because the press was so small, it could have gone out of business at any moment. And so that was my start. I published Lee.
So tell us a bit about Lee. First of all, is the main character Lee
yes.
you? Yes. How much of him is you, and how much of him is a fiction?
Well, Lee is the person that I would be if I had the guts. You know, if I had more courage, I would be Lee.
Okay.
But I don't, you know, because I behave more or less acceptably, whereas Lee does not. And Lee's mission in life is to punish ignorant people, punish people who have refused to educate themselves. He's an old man in this book, as old as I am now. I wrote the book when I was in my 50s, but I was writing about an older man, and by God, I have become that older man now. But he would stride around town with a heavy walking stick. He just beat the hell out of people, you know, whom he disapproved of. And his wife was dead by this time. And he imagined, he resurrects her in his imagination and has conversations with her. And he resurrects her at different ages in his, because of his mental illness. He is able to bring her back to life in spectral form. And she's his intermittent companion as he goes through life. He can bring her back to life in imagination and talk to her. Meanwhile, he goes about committing crimes, you know, beating people he doesn't approve of, and finally gets in trouble with the police, is captured, and then finally goes out into the forest late at night when it's very cold and allows himself to freeze to death, which is the end of that story. But it's a very bitter novel. And it offends me. Women don't like the novel, I don't think. Some men like it. Judy likes it. So that was my first published book. And oddly enough, it's the book people mostly still talk about whenever anybody talks at all about any of my novels. That's the one they home in on.
So how did it do in terms of sales and
critically did well. All my novels do well critically, but sales are wretched, visual, and I don't really sell very few. I mean, none of my books sell well.
Mm-hmm.
They remaindered the book or pulped it or something. It was reprinted later on Overlook Press. Overlook Press reprinted it in paperback later on, and it sold some. Not many.
Right.
They also, Overlook also published another book of mine called Fields of Asphodel in hardback. Neither of them sell particularly well. They didn't publicize. They sent me out to do the publicizing, and I did. I went traveled all over the South to book conferences, and I gave readings. But it sold very poorly.
Did you take a stick and whack people
yeah,
over the head?
I should have.
Well, it would have gotten you some publicity, I imagine.
Yeah.
So, what kind of things did the critics say about Lee?
Well, the very first review I got was very negative. It was a short review in, what's that journal?
Publishers Weekly.
Right.
The girl there didn't care for it at all. I think it was the only negative review in the whole issue of that magazine. She didn't like it at all, because she didn't like the character. I mean, a lot of women don't. He's not a likable character.
Right.
And, you know, he's brutal and intolerant and sarcastic and scatological, and people
he's
don't
bitter.
Like, yes, very bitter.
Yeah, one of the things that came to my mind as I was reading this book was, if I had read it when I was 20 years old, I would have found it to be very unappealing and want to set it down. But when I read it in my 40s, I realized You know, as you go through life, you accumulate more things that you feel bitter about. And I thought, I hope this isn't going to be me when I'm in my 70s. So did you, you wrote this in your 50s, did you age in the way that Lee aged? Are you the man that Lee is, or are you a bit mellower?
Very much like that, really. I mean, you know, my attitude toward institutions, toward current day life in this country, has become very bitter. I'm very much like Lee, except that I don't break the law.
Right.
And it's very foolish to break the law if you're a bitter person.
Right.
You don't want to give the handle. You don't want to give the advantage to the forces of law.
Yeah.
So you'd be very careful about not breaking the law. Except for that, I'm very much like Lee.
Right.
Tend to be isolate, and tend to avoid society.
Right.
And tend to cuddle up with my wife and my books and my dogs, and that's what makes me happy.
So, would you describe yourself as a pessimist?
Yes.
How about a misanthrope?
Well, yes, I guess so. Yeah. I guess I am.
Those are two words that are thrown around a lot about Lee, as I recall.
I suppose I'm misanthropic in the same way that Jonathan Swift was misanthropic,
right?
Or in the same way that Greek playwright Aristophanes,
right?
Same way that he was misanthropic.
So, what writers have your novels been likened to? Your style and your choice of subject matter, your treatment of it. Are you often compared to any established writers?
Well, I am sometimes, in an oblique way, compared to others, but most people point out that they're very different from anything else.
Right.
You know, that I'm not really very much like any other writer. And maybe a little bit like Celine.
Right.
I suppose that's the writer I most resemble.
So tell me, what writers have influenced you as a writer, influenced your style of writing? Has anybody really influenced your style or your outlook?
Well, Faulkner has, because Celine has, because he taught me that you can say anything you want to say. There are no rules. You can disclose unpleasant attitudes. You can demolish other people with impunity. There are no laws. That's what I don't much like Celine as a writer. But that aspect of it, you know, where he could insult anybody, anytime, anywhere, that I did take to. And when it comes to the unrealistic parts of my novels, I think I was influenced by Faulkner, where he will have, like in The Sound and the Fury, writing in italics is thought. It's all thought, not action. I had to read the whole book before I realized what he was doing.
Right.
But, you know, half of the writing is in italics. That's just what he's thinking. It's like an overvoice in a movie, you know, where somebody narrates what's going on. And that appealed to me. So some of my novels are surreal to a point, you know, that they are departed. I'm not at all realistic. And I get criticized for being incredible, my book being not credible. Right. Well, then I'm supposed to be credible. You know, it's not supposed to be realistic. It's supposed to be thought and emotion. With nothing, you know, like when I resurrect this woman, I mean, I'm not insane. I know that she's not.
Right.
She doesn't. But the emotion is unreal. Doesn't need to be real. It's what goes on in a human being's head. I'm interested in what goes on in a person's head. Most writers are interested in what a person does with his hands.
Right.
In other words, they're interested in action. They're interested in what people do. I don't care what people do. I just want to know what they're thinking.
Right.
That's why when I cannot follow plots on mystery movies. You know, I don't care what the plot is. What I want to know is, what's the ambience? You know, how good an actor is this person? What is the spirit of the thing? What's this color scheme? You know, are the scenes picture worthy? Could that scene be a painting?
Right.
But who killed who doesn't matter. At least that to me. You know, Judy has to tell me later on what has happened. I don't know what's happened. So that's the way I write. You know, I just want to see what goes on between the ears. You know, whether a person is a murderer or electrical engineer or, you know, or a test pilot, matters nothing to me.
That's interesting. The writers that I thought of when I was reading your novels are, because a lot of them, well, they have predominantly a southern setting and a slight element of the grotesque. One writer I think of is Flannery O'Connor, who's a favorite of mine. Another writer that I think of when I read your work is Gogol. Because one of the things that Gogol does that I find incredibly droll is he describes things that cannot actually be pictured, like a man's nose leaving town disguised as a civil servant.
Yeah.
And you have similar little the things like that. And one thing I do have to say is that a lot of people hone in on the misanthropy of your novels. There's not a single page where I don't find something that's genuinely funny, and not a single page where I don't find something worth underlining just because it's so beautifully expressed.
Well, thank you. I never set out to be funny, but these things just pop up out of nowhere, you know, without my even wanting them. I will see an irony somewhere and I'll put it down, but it's never my intention to be funny. It's funny you mentioned Flannery O'Connor, because that's one writer I really do not like at all. I just cannot abide her. And although she's Southern and she's a Georgia girl, I find her boring as hell. She just bores me to death.
That's fascinating.
Like Percy Walker.
Walker Percy?
Walker Percy.
Yeah.
He's praised as being another, he's a Catholic theologian and all the rest, but bores me to absolute tears. I cannot read it. I've read all his books, but I don't know why, because I don't really like it. But I love Faulkner. Uh-huh. And I love one of my favorite novels is George Orwell, 1984.
I think that is a brilliant novel. I think people underestimate its brilliance as a novel.
It's a beautiful novel.
Yeah.
And horrifying. It is the most horrifying novel you could ever possibly read.
Yeah.
Particularly that scene where his lover comes and sits on the bench next to after they've both been to room 101.
Right.
They've both been brainwashed. And they don't care about each other anymore. I mean, love has been wiped out of them.
Yeah.
And they've been erased. They've been turned into blanks.
They've been erased as human beings.
Yeah, that's right. They're no longer... This is Orwell's view of communism. He saw into the heart of communism. He had been associated with the communists in Spain, for example.
Yeah.
When he was fighting with the anti-fascist side of Spain. He got to know some communists. I've been reading recently... Whitaker Chambers' book, Witnessed, where he talks about the Alger Hiss trial. And he got a glimpse of the heart of communism, what the real communism is, which is the desire to turn human nature upside down, to change human nature, to erase it and rebuild it, to take away, to destroy the ego. You know, the most horrible, you know, to destroy the aesthetic sense, to make people automatons. Automatons, turn people into robots. You know, I mean, what could be more harm? That's much worse than death.
Yeah, yeah.
And Chambers saw that clearly.
I haven't read Witness. It's something I should add to that giant stack.
Yeah, right.
So what was your next novel after Lee in terms of your publication history?
Well, after Lee, this, my first one was A Sweet Sitting Manuscript, which was my autobiography, essentially.
Yeah.
Then I wrote Lee. Having written the Sweet Sitting Manuscript, I was free of that. I was free of autobiography. And I could write about anything I wanted. I had to get that out of my conscience, you know. I had to write about my friends, Luke and Phyllis, who both were dead by this time. My adventures in Antioch, you know, my adventures in getting kicked out of school. That I took care of in the Sweet Sitting Manuscript. So this set me free to write about other things other than myself. So I wrote about Lee, thinking that would be other than myself, but it turned out to be a lot about myself. Then, Then I wrote a very experimental book, very strange book, called Opportunities in Alabama Agriculture, which is a homage to my grandparents. And I wanted to make the South seem like Old Testament days. I wanted it to seem bleak. You know, when you read the Old Testament, you get the impression that there are only about five or six people in the world. You know, Adam and Eve and their sons. And
yeah.
It's just a little community of, everybody's very important because there's so few people. You know, I mean, the Old Testament doesn't look at anybody except for this little group of people.
Yeah.
You would never know that there are any Chinese in the world. You know?
Right.
So that's what I wanted opportunities to be like. You know, this little community of farmers, dirt poor farmers, as my ancestors were. My ancestors were very poor people. You know, they were sharecroppers and whatnot. And I wanted to talk about them and their very narrow but very passionate horizons. You know, whether it rains or not becomes a major concern. And whether or not they can afford to buy a new. This is a major matter for them. This is life and death. And I wanted, and these were very remarkable people, my ancestors, my great great parents on my mother's side. And my grandfather on my mother's side became a mail carrier. And he thought that he was in paradise, that he had a job that was paid for by the government. In other words, he was secure.
Yeah.
And envied by all his neighbors because he had a regular paycheck. So he was a very conscientious mail carrier. In addition, he farmed. So he did well for himself with no education at all. No education. Four children. And I never met him. He died a day or two before I was to meet him. When I was born in Chile, you know.
Right.
And my grandparents needed my mother to come home to Elba, Alabama. To Brent, Alabama. To come home and help out. She was in Chile with my father, of course. But she flew back to Alabama to help her mother and took me with her. So I was flying from Chile to Alabama when I was 3 years old, you know, on a plane. And but before we got there, he died. So I missed seeing him by maybe 48 hours. Never saw my grandfather. And we stayed in Brent for several months to help out my widowed grandmother. And then went back to Chile where my father was working. So I had a glimpse of that kind of life. Even as 3 years old, I remembered some of it. Later on, we visited frequently. So I knew what it was like to be a farmer in 1940s Alabama and what a tough life it was and how manfully my grandfather managed it. And my grandmother, you know, who they both worked 12 hours a day to survive. You know, my grandmother would go out in the morning and kill a chicken and pluck it and fry it up for breakfast. That was the beginning of her day. And build a fire and then go to work in the chicken house and collect the eggs. I mean, these people were never at rest just to survive. And I saw all of that and saw what they had to do, what kind of lives they had. So I wanted to write a book in homage to this kind of life. But I also wanted it to be eerie, strange. You know, when you see a very old movie, you know, the film will be overexposed, will be white.
Yeah.
The film will be white, and then it'll get back in focus, and it'll change focus. And you get the impression when you see a movie like that, that you're looking at a movie that was made 10,000 years ago. That's what I wanted the book to look like. Something that happened hundreds of years ago among these primeval people living in an Old Testament world. So it was sort of an experimental novel. And it was published by Baskerville Press. Baskerville now specializes in writing biographies of opera singers. That's not all they publish anymore. But at that time they published fiction. And so they published it. Jeff, what's his name? See, I can't remember. So Jeff Putnam, who was an opera singer himself, published it. He liked it. I'm not sure anybody else liked it, but sold very, very poorly. And they made up a real nice cover for the book. I think you have a copy of it around here.
Yeah.
And so that was my third book that I published.
And how was that received in terms of critics? Did it get widely reviewed again?
Not widely. It had one or two reviews that were favorable. One of the reviewers said that it was pointed out how strange it was and praised it for its oddities.
Yeah.
But then there was no great reception, very few reviews.
Another stylistic thing that your books brought to mind, another writer that your books brought to mind, for me, was Gabriel García Márquez. Specifically 100 Years of Solitude, yeah. Because of his magical realism, yes. Because there are certain elements of your work that are just sort of magical, like there are volcanoes in Alabama, yeah. Things don't quite make sense in terms of the physical universe that
right.
we know of
yes.
yet. And these things are just sort of there in the background, smoking away, or things happen that can't quite happen, or you've got certain implements like the Scribblator in your later novels that you can't really quite imagine what it is because they seem to be machines, but they also seem to have minds of their own and legs of their own, so... That does bring to mind García Márquez and his best work, not his worst stuff, which is very, very bad, but the best stuff is just so droll because these things are happening, they don't make sense, you can't picture them, and yet you don't reject it or anything. It's not something that's repugnant, it's just delightful.
It's like a dream. In a dream, anything can happen, and incongruous things happen. People meet each other in dreams. One of them has been dead for 500 years, it's impossible. But in dreams, everything becomes possible. So I wanted to write a book, where you could just, like making a stew, you throw in some carrots, you throw in some lettuce, you throw in some meat, and you mix it all up. You try to come out with something that's dense and rich.
Yeah.
And that's what I've tried to do.
Did you do any research with family diaries and papers and things to come up with the Opportunities book? Or was it mostly a product of your imagination?
I invented a good deal of stuff.
Yeah.
For example, the protagonist, my grandfather, owns 100 acres or so of land. It has an edge, the edge of the world.
Yeah.
This land goes down to the very edge of the world.
Right.
And he sits there sometimes on the edge of the world looking out at planets and stars whizzing by him. So, and also I imagined this black family, this is true, black families would just sometimes build a house on his land without asking.
Right.
They would just assume that the land belonged to everybody, anybody.
Right.
And he would let them stay there, So they'd have black family living a couple hundred yards away on his land.
Right.
And that's true. I put that in the book. And a lot of it's true. Actually, happened. For example, when he had beehives, and he would go out once in a while, collect the combs, and he would hang up a chamois cloth from the ceiling, put the combs in the chamois cloth, and squeeze the honey out, and let it drain into a jar, so that
right.
the honey would be pure; it wouldn't have any comb in it. That he did. He did that. I saw him do that. Not him, but I saw his widow do that. And it was a violent area, too, where fights, killings were going on. So I would say it's three forces based on real things, on reality. About a fourth of it is just pure invention.
Well, what was your next book after Opportunities?
After Opportunities, I wrote The New Austerities. New Austerities, which is a family, very autobiographical.
Yeah.
My wife and myself living in New York and hating, loathing. And this is based on the time when I worked for an insurance company in New York. But my salary was so meager that we lived from hand to mouth and I was out of place. And I don't belong up north. That's just a sin being Kyrgyzstan. To be up in New York. not my kind of place at all. These short people with their short language, you know, the snappy answers, you know, they're hurrying about from one place to another. You know, I'm a leisurely sort of guy. I couldn't stand it, you know. The New Yorker people are so businesslike, brusque, to the point right away. You go to buy a ticket, and if you don't pronounce, I'd go to a restaurant and say, could I have a piece of pie, please?
They say, what?
I said, pie, apple pie. Hey, Tony, come here, see what this guy's trying to say, you know. Pie. I said, oh, you mean pie. Yeah, that's what I mean. So I couldn't communicate, you know, and my habits were different. I'm sure I looked different, and I was accepted. I can't blame them for rejecting me. They didn't reject me, I rejected them. I was always able to make a living, always able to get a job. I lived in Kew Gardens, which considered a nice area. It seemed like a slum to me, you know. I mean, you know, where do you walk your dog, you know, on the sidewalk? You know, I'm used to having 100 acres in front of me. You know?
Right.
And I'm used to looking up and seeing the sky. And instead of being enclosed in this gray capsule of apartment buildings, you know, it just horrifies me. So Julie, born in New York, she was more used to it than I was, but she got to where she didn't like it either. Anyway, so the story is about a family trapped in New York City. New York City, they want the hell to get out of there as quick as possible and take a road back home again, the road home back to Alabama. And so I wrote a long stretch about the travel itself. The trip from New York to Alabama, and I make it a long, it takes 3 or 4 days, and the hero is driving a beat-up old Volvo that only goes 40 miles an hour, you know, and,
with lots of books and classical music.
That's right, full of books, ballast, you know. And so he has adventures on the highway, which is pure fiction, of course.
Yeah.
And he finally comes home again, gets down and kisses the earth, you know, to be back in the South again.
But there's a certain amount of having to deal with the I told you so's of the people back home who sort of said, we told you so, why did you ever think you would ever want to go away?
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
And my parents are as Southern as you can get. My father worked for a while in Schenectady, New York, General Electric. Hated it. Did well, but hated it. And there's something about being the kind of Southerner I am. It's just cannot abide big cities. I mean, I consider this city a nightmare right here.
Right.
Even though we're in this beautiful area.
Right.
I just cannot stand big cities. Indication of how misanthropic I am. So many goddamn ignorant human beings walking around.
Crawling all over each other like in an anthill or something.
Yeah.
I can only take big cities in small doses. Whenever I go back to Montana where I grew up, I'm always amazed. I open the door and I hear birds chirping. Yes. I don't hear airplanes. The rumbling of streetcars, the rumbling of traffic, horns honking, sirens blaring.
Yeah.
It's just deafening after a while. And when you're away from it, you realize how much ambient noise you deal with.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's just birds, the wind. It's a huge relief.
The economy, too. The house that I live in Alabama, is modest, a modest house.
Yeah.
But I have a lake, and I have no neighbors within 500 or 600 yards. And to live like that in New York becomes millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah. You have to be a multimillionaire in New York to lead a decent middle-class lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's absurd. It's ridiculous. So, I really found The New Austerities to be a very moving book. And how did that do again? Who published it? When did it come out?
Well, that was another funny story. All of my publications turned out to be funny stories. There was an editor working for Peachtree Press in Atlanta, here in Atlanta. She published mostly children's books, but she ventured into adult fiction from time to time. And she had an editor there named Emily Wright, who was, had a PhD in literature from Columbia, so she was an educated woman. And just by the sheerest coincidence, she came to work one day and there was a pile of manuscripts for her to consider. And mine just happened to be on the top by sheer coincidence. Mine was the first one she picked up. But she went back into her room to read it and immediately liked it. And then she read the others and didn't much care for the others. So she wanted to publish this book. And the woman who owns that press is a very mercenary type. I mean, she's a profit-minded woman. She saw that this book wouldn't make any money. Nobody would read this book. She didn't deny that it was good, but, you know, that it was not a good publishing venture. So this editor, God bless her, said, "You've got to publish. You know, whether you want to, you must publish this book." And so she did. Maybe wait about 6 months, but did publish it. And that's how it came into being. And she published 1,500 copies and sold about 500. But she left her with a backlog of 1,000 copies. And she couldn't sell them. So I called her one time and says, "What would you charge for those books?" And she said, "Well, I'll give them to you for $1 apiece. So I drove up here to Atlanta and picked up 1,000 copies for $1,000. So I have 1,000 copies in my house back in Alabama. That's why I don't mind giving them away or selling them or whatever anybody wants.
Well, that's great. Well, we have gone for an hour now, and yeah. I think it's a good time to take a break.
Yeah.
So, Tito, Judy, thank you very much. I should have mentioned at the beginning that Judy Perdue is also here, Tito's wife, keeping him honest. So, we're going to take a break, and we will continue with your literary journey.
All right.